Welcome to DC EKG, where we diagnose Washington, D.C.'s policy diseases and provide needed prescriptions. I'm Joe Grogan, along with Eric Euland. We want to thank our sponsor, Survivors for Solutions, which is run by our very talented producer, John C.Z. Swartacki. John is a survivor himself, and he fights to make every patient a survivor, both today and tomorrow. Today, it's my pleasure to welcome Greg D'Angelo to the podcast. Greg's expertise in healthcare policy is wide and deep, having served as the Associate Director of Health Programs at the White House Office of Management and Budget, where he oversaw the staggering $1.4 trillion annual healthcare budget for the Department of Health and Human Services. He's also a longtime veteran of Capitol Hill, having served on the Budget Committee there, and having overlapped at some point on the Hill with Eric Euland. Maybe he'll tell us a few stories about Eric, which would be to entertain me, if no one else. It's a pleasure to have you here, Greg. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Greg, let's dive right into it. This week, President Biden submitted his FY 2025 budget. He requested $7.2 trillion in spending, a $400 billion increase from last year. This nearly $2 trillion alone would just be discretionary spending, the annual amounts of money spent by the federal government. He put $1.8 trillion aside for the Health and Human Services budget, of which $130.7 or $131 billion is discretionary. He proposed $90 trillion in overall spending in 10 years, $16 trillion in deficits, $12 trillion in interest costs, and $5 trillion in new taxes. For the budget geeks out there, these are all rounded numbers, but for our purposes, keeping these big chunks in mind is kind of how we're going to approach this discussion. Greg, considering your extensive experience at OMB doing health policy in the private sector and at think tanks and service up in the Senate Budget Committee, sure, you've got a lot of great insights into the intricacies of federal budgeting overall and health policy and health budgeting in particular. With that in mind, how do you view President Biden's fiscal agenda for the upcoming year on the budget front, particularly with now his budget out and everybody having had a chance to take a look at it?
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for the question. Thanks, Joe and Eric, for having me on today. You know, the way I view the president's budget is it's a political document. It's usually a statement of administration policy. But I think especially this year, in an election year, it's a highly political document. I think, you know, as I read it, I didn't find a whole lot that was surprising. If you saw the budget last year, you know, then you saw it this year, in a sense. So in the healthcare space, the major proposals are largely the same. The president doubles down on the IRA, expanding price controls, you know, expanding Obamacare subsidies and making them permanent, the enhanced subsidies, creating a new Medicaid-like program to cover the Medicaid coverage gap in states that didn't expand. So a lot of new spending, some new price controls. And then there were some budget gimmicks and accounting tricks similar to past years where the president's stuffing some of the savings into the Medicare HI trust fund to appear as if he's extending the life of it. Also proposing, you know, new tax increases on individuals over $400,000 and putting those funds into the HI trust fund. And then transferring the Medicare net investment income tax into the trust fund. So essentially stuffing the trust fund with receipts to make it look like it was the program was made solvent indefinitely, which was not the case. But as you can see in an election year, it may be good politics for the president to claim he's making Medicare permanently solvent when in fact he's not changing the trajectory of the program one iota.
So could you unpack that a little bit and explain for our listeners what's actually going on here? I agree the budget and the president's rhetoric and his whole team's rhetoric is all about extending Medicare solvency. Here on the show, we've talked off and on with a whole bunch of different smart people about the Medicare program, how the so-called trust fund, from a budget perspective, so-called, actually works, the mechanics of it, and ultimately what's going to happen according to the Medicare trustees to the operations of the trust fund in potentially as a few less than 10 years. So when the president claims that he is fixing the problems of the Medicare trust fund, what's actually going on there?
Sure. Well, when you think about the trust fund, there really are two parts. There's the HI trust fund, which is Medicare Part A, and that, you know, funds basically hospital expenses, and that is funded through a payroll tax. And so, you know, you can either make the program solvent by increasing taxes, or you could do so by restraining spending and making the program more sustainable in terms of its fiscal trajectory on the spending side of the equation. The other trust fund for SMI, for Part B, essentially never goes out of balance. Spending, you know, ultimately, you know, it increases and the revenues kind of match that based on expected spending. So it basically, you know, premiums, you know, increase, and then the amount of general revenue that gets transferred to that trust fund automatically increases. So effectively, as spending in that trust fund grows, you just crowd out other spending in the budget. And so on that side of Medicare, you know, the key is in particular is restraining its spending growth. That's the way to make that solvent. But here in the budget, essentially what the president is doing is increasing taxes and basically using an accounting gimmick to show as if the HI trust fund is better off than it really is. So it's putting revenues into that trust fund, and also crediting some savings that would occur elsewhere, like in the SMI trust fund, and crediting those savings as if they occurred in the HI trust fund. So it's really all smoke and mirrors and accounting gimmicks, not real reforms that actually would reduce program spending in a sustainable way. And it's really just a bunch of accounting gimmicks and accounting tricks.
And so, to your point, budget's just a proposal. It doesn't make actual changes to the operation of the trust fund. And so therefore, as a display device, he's claiming all these outcomes. But the reality is the trust fund just continues to chug away regardless of any presidential proposals. And it seems Congress is not super excited about processing any pieces or parts of the president's budget this year. So to your point earlier, you said this is pretty consistent with where he was last year. Is it your expectation, especially based on the first couple of years of the Biden administration, that when it comes to congressional Democrats and Team Biden, that they're going to continue to talk about ways that they are preserving and protecting Medicare, but with the reality of them not actually accomplishing that, that there's an opportunity for Republicans to talk a little bit about Democratic claims versus the facts and demonstrate that Republicans are actually been the team that's done a much better job with the Medicare trust fund here during their time in office.
Yeah, Eric, I think you raised a number of great points. Like you said, the president's budget is his request. And so on the discretionary side, he's requesting a certain amount of discretionary spending. On the mandatory side of the ledger and on taxes, the president's making proposals and Congress either acts on them or doesn't. In particular, on the healthcare, in the healthcare space and with respect to Medicare, if you look at, say, the prescription drug proposals where the president's saying, let's double down on the IRA, let's expand the number of drugs that are negotiated and accelerate that, you know, those were proposals that even a Democrat-controlled Congress did not act on. So this Congress will not act on those. And then when you get into some of the other proposals like, you know, increasing taxes on high-income individuals, you know, same is true, right? And so these things aren't going to happen. They're about the political messaging and the rhetoric going into the campaign. And I think your point is definitely valid, Eric, and it's right that Republicans can actually talk about the things that they have done and that they will do. But for the president, yeah, this is more of a messaging document and exercise. I don't expect much action in relation to these proposals, given the divided Congress and the fact that when they had unified control, you know, these sorts of things didn't fly.
So when to that point, you know, they've had the opportunity to strengthen the trust fund, right? In the first few years, they had the House and the Senate, and Biden was in the White House. When they passed the IRA, they could have taken the savings from the drug negotiations. Was it $180 billion in savings, $200 billion in savings? They could have thrown that into the trust fund. They chose not to. They chose to spend it on green energy. when we'll talk a little bit later about the rebate rule, I think. But when they pushed that out and canceled that, they could have thrown that money into the trust fund. They chose not to. And let's going back even further, when the surtax was put on Medicare to pay for Obamacare, they explicitly avoided strengthening the trust fund and they added a Medicare tax and used the money to go to expanding a whole new health program. So they've consistently, the disconnect is really kind of remarkable, and why Republicans don't pound them on this is really kind of striking. I mean, Biden's rhetoric at the State of the Union this year and last year was very strident. I won't allow anyone to cut Medicare, but the numbers don't lie. I mean, he took money out of Medicare for the IRA and he spent it on the Green New Deal.
Absolutely. So there's really two things at work here in this point. I think it's a great point. The first is, if you look back at the examples you cited, the IRA, as well as the Obamacare debate, particularly the second Obamacare bill, the reconciliation bill, both were in reconciliation. So because of the rules in reconciliation, they couldn't take money and put it into the trust fund. So if these savings were occurring outside of the trust fund, they couldn't basically put it into the trust fund. They tried to do that actually in 2010, the Democrats, with the net investment income tax, but it was going to violate the rules. So they couldn't pull these accounting tricks because they don't have real fiscal effects. So they wouldn't fit the reconciliation rules. But to your point, regardless of whether or not they were putting money into the trust fund, you know, if there were savings to be had, they had long spent them, right? To expand Obamacare, to do other things. And so from a fiscal standpoint, they never were going to actually improve the net fiscal position of the federal government or of the program,
right?
Aside from the accounting tricks.
So I just want to unpack that for 1 second because it's so arcane, but because we're in a world where big bills are only getting passed by reconciliation, and you and Euland are, you know, there's like 4 or 5 people in this town who really understand reconciliation, and you and Euland are 2 of them. So when you do a reconciliation bill, it's got to be budgetary effects, correct? And you're saying that because of the rules of reconciliation, can you explain this? Is it the cuts need to go into particular accounts, or it needs to go into this? You can't move money from one account to another. What were you just explaining to people?
So essentially, any provision in a reconciliation bill has to change mandatory spending or affect, you know, tax revenues. And if it doesn't, it needs to be, you know, what's a necessary term and condition to effectuate the provision. So it's not necessary to transfer money into a different trust fund or account, right? Those are accounting changes that, you know, Congress might want to make, but they don't need to make in order to effectuate the provision. And so moving from here, money from here to there, you know, you can't do that in reconciliation. And I don't know, Eric, if you have any other insights or a better way to explain that, but I think that's sort of how I would think about it.
Yeah, that's a bedrock principle that's been pretty clear inside reconciliation since it kind of hit its modern form about 30 plus years ago. And so to the extent that people have ever explored how to shore up Medicare and improve its finances, the rules of reconciliation kind of drive you towards looking at proposals inside the operations of Medicare itself, or have this weird, almost accounting trick at the end of the day of increasing revenues on particular classes of people. And then, you know, there's a knock-on effect in terms of money going into the trust fund as you adjust people's responsibility to pay to the federal government. But that's one of the many reasons that Medicare, at least for Democrats, has been a rhetorical show for decades here, where combined with attacks on Republicans for somehow wanting to cut Medicare, along with claims not validated by reality that somehow they are fixing Medicare's finances. And they have not done anything other than that since we went through a whole bunch of Medicare struggles in the mid-1990s.
Yeah. And it's really, I mean, it's arcane in a way, Eric, right? But in some ways, it's kind of simple, right? Like, the way to shore up Medicare is to find savings within Medicare and don't spend it on other stuff.
Right. Oh, there we go.
Right.
So let's, because I walked into that, and because we're in a little bit of budget geekery, let's talk about, we'll get to some other policies, but let's take a moment just to talk about what they did on the rebate rule. For those of us who follow the rebate rule drama for years now, in the waning days of the Trump administration, a regulatory rule was issued to eliminate, some ways in which PBMs receive rebates. This was projected to cost almost $200 billion because it would lessen the ability of PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers, to negotiate effectively against pharmaceutical manufacturers. And because Medicare is so heavily subsidized, this would drive up Medicare premiums. And the Congressional Budget Office made assumptions about how much money it would cost the federal government in increased subsidies. And then the Democrats pushed the effective date of that rule when they came into Congress. So then the Congressional Budget Office says, okay, this is sort of ridiculous. We don't think this thing is ever going to go into effect. We are no longer going to give you savings for pushing out the effective date. And they took it out of the budgetary projections, what's called the baseline projections of budgetary growth that CBO uses and that everybody has to key off, whether or not something costs the federal government money or is going to increase the revenues coming into the Treasury. Now, OMB in this budget put it back in the baseline for 3 years. It's kicking in 2032, then 2033, 2034 for a cost to the federal government of $68 billion. Now, this is unusual because OMB, Office of Management Budget, and the Congressional Budget Office communicate on a fairly regular basis, and they want to be on the same page. And sometimes there are differences in their projections for technical reasons, but by and large, they try and be on the same page on big issues. But this demonstrates some type of dispute or controversy between the Biden administration's Office of Management and Budget and the Congressional Budget Office. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of that? And if you had ever encountered either on the Budget Committee or at OMB a dispute like this before?
Yeah, that's a great question, Joe. And I have. There have been differences in budget baseline assumptions. When you think about the cost sharing reduction subsidies, for example, in Obamacare, OMB and CBO's treatment there diverged for a period of time. But in particular, in this case, I found it interesting because if you look at the provisions that delayed the rebate rule, it just said it couldn't be implemented before 2032, effectively. So after 2031, it could be implemented, not that it necessarily would be, right? And so I think the way I view it is less of a technical dispute between CBO and OMB. In my mind, it's more of, it was a policy choice to keep it in. Whether that was explicitly made by the politicals or implicitly by the careers, and that they just assumed, well, it will be implemented when the prohibition on implementing it is kind of over. But the thing that the OMB career staff kind of reminded me when I was in that role, and Joe, you probably recall this, is, yeah, it's the president's budget baseline. And there are differences from CBO, and you can make choices about what's in and what's out. So I find it interesting. And so, not really sure what the motive is. If I had been in that seat, from their perspective, if they don't like the rule, it's easy to pull it from the baseline and get $68 billion in administrative savings. Makes the budget look rosier. Kind of why wouldn't they do that? One can make the case for leaving it in, and that, the rule did go into, did get finalized. It could go into effect under at that date in 2032. But it is a little peculiar. I mean, I suppose the administration could claim that they're doing something on PBM reform, even though they're not. In the out years, by saying that they're going to let this rule potentially live on in some future administration. But to be honest with you, the whole thing is a little bit peculiar to me, because if they didn't like the rule, they would pull it from the baseline, and leaving it in there doesn't, to your point, Joe, get you any potential legislative savings either. Because, you know, yes, this administration has proposed on a number of occasions and in fact signed laws that have, you know, essentially delayed the rule, taken the savings and spent it on other things. But CBO is not going to score it that way. So they can keep proposing that in future legislation, but they're not going to get scorable savings. So they're not really getting that benefit. So it's a very peculiar situation. Well, I'm not sure why it's still in there.
Not to dwell on this, but I tell me whether I'm insane. I'm going to spin out a hypothetical for you. And then you tell me whether or not that's the dumbest thing you've ever heard. But let's suppose Trump were to win the election. So now you've got, and his first budget puts it in the, carries it out to be of the fourth year in the baseline. So now you've got not $68 billion in the budget, the Trump's first budget. You've got 77, you know, almost $80 billion, I think, would be in the baseline for that additional year. So you got $80 billion now in the baseline. What if they want to, the Republican Congress wants to use that 80, CBO is taking it out of the baseline, and now you've got a situation where Republicans are telling CBO, you let the Democrats use this thing three times to pass major legislation, and now you're telling us we can't use it. Can you see a situation where the budget committees could freak out on CBO, either a directed scoring situation or a political dispute of some sort, and pressure on CBO to change their scoring? I mean, it just seems very odd to me that now that it's been put, there's a precedent for it being in the baseline. You could set up a situation where you've got, if nothing else, a political dispute about using those savings.
Yeah. And I think it also gets down to like intent, like does the administration ever intend to implement it? Right. And so you could see an administration that says, yeah, we do intend to implement it. And perhaps in this case, I mean, I often wonder when CBO pulled it from their baseline, you know, they were kind of referring to Congress, you know, Congress, you know, acted three times. So, you know, therefore this is unlikely to go into effect. But did they talk to this administration, you know, in terms of whether they would implement? Obviously it's beyond their term, so it probably wasn't directly relevant, but to my point, as you get closer in the future administration, closer to that year when it could be implemented, what does that administration say about their plans to implement it or not? And I think that could have a bearing on the debate.
And Greg, again, to be in this rabbit hole for a little bit longer, but you have worked in the past pretty directly with CBO directors and CBO staff, obviously, as well. You've led OMB staff. When it comes to CBO just determining ex cathedra someday, one day, that, whoops, well, we're just not going to pay attention to this anymore. It's never going to happen. There has to have been a thought process that people went through. To Joe's scenario, a new administration comes in, the Trump second term, and they're going to declare they want to do this. How does CBO go about being convinced or thinking through that, wow, we made the wrong call, we need to admit of that and adjust? How do you interact and other partisan staff interact with CBO staff who present themselves clearly as technical experts and people who are not trying to curry partisan favor, but to go through and make the case and convince them that in this instance or many other instances, they've looked at it incorrectly and there needs to be adjustments or changes to how they evaluate and score things.
Yeah, it's a good question, Eric. So there's usually some consultation with the four corners of the budget committee, you know, so the Democrat, Republican staff, the minority and the majority, and usually they try to get alignment and agreement on what the appropriate, you know, treatment is in the budget and in the baseline. And sometimes there is a consultation with the administration as well, and routine scorekeeping meetings where these issues are, you know, debated and hashed out, and they try to find kind of consensus. But ultimately, you know, as I think Joe kind of referenced earlier, the budget baseline is ultimately up to the budget committee chairman. And so I think they try to get, you know, alignment between the four corners of the budget committee and the administration, but ultimately the chairman does decide what's in and out of the baseline and can ultimately instruct CBO. That rarely happens, but it could happen.
And so in this instance, just play that out, it's possible that a Republican chairman of the House and Senate budget committees would instruct CBO to construct a baseline for all their budget spending appropriations and tax reduction and mandatory work, with this included yet again.
they could, particularly if OMB continues to carry it. I think that that helps bolster their case, to your point, Joe. You know, there's a reason OMB has it in there. It's a choice. They could have taken it out.
Right. A very tangled web in the world in here.
So, Greg, you mentioned earlier that in the Biden budget, there's a proposal to double down and expand on Inflation Reduction Act's prescription drug negotiation plan. In CBO's evaluation of the Biden proposals on prescription drugs negotiation, CBO repeatedly concluded that in the instance of the imposition of such a process, it would have a price control impact, but as importantly, would also reduce the production and the ability to innovate and find new life-saving cures. Is it a natural conclusion then that the Biden proposal to expand how this drug negotiation price control regime works could have a further negative impact on pharmaceutical creation and ultimately life-sustaining and quality of life-enhancing drugs?
Yeah, I do think so, Eric. And as you, I think Joe has even written on, I mean, there are additional analyses out there that show that, you know, CBO hasn't, you know, assumed that this effect is large enough. In fact, CBO has been rethinking its analysis and has, you know, sought out independent research to reshape its analysis. So I do think, yeah, like you're doubling down on it would probably make that problem worse. I think, unfortunately, this budget contains very little detail in the way of how he's expanding it. I think the president of the State of the Union said expanding the negotiation to up to 500 drugs over a decade, but there's very little, in fact, there's nothing in the budget documents using that number or explaining the specifics or how they'd explain the IRA. It's merely a policy plug, assuming $200 billion in savings over 10 years. And that $200 billion is for the whole suite of policy proposals, not just the expanded negotiation, but extending the inflation caps to the commercial market and a couple other proposals in relation to the IRA. And so it's really hard to kind of understand what they're proposing here because it's simply a plug. But I'd say, generally speaking, just the concept of extending the number of drugs that are negotiated, would exacerbate the effect that you're talking about and that CBO has estimated.
So in a world where people try to take a presidential budget under their belt up on Capitol Hill, but there are significant ideas that, to your point, are just policy plugs, besides trying to get cabinet secretaries up and explain themselves, are there other ways that Congress can unpack policy plugs and try to come to a clearer understanding of what an administration is trying to do? Are there conversations that are held with staff between members of Congress and various administration offices, agencies, and departments, letters, budget tables? Where do you go to kind of figure out that, oh, here's a $200 billion plug, but here's what they really mean underneath all that?
Yeah, great question, Eric. So I think the answer is all of the above. You know, there's the main budget volume, all the other budget documents, you know, the appendix, the analytical perspectives, each of the agencies, congressional justifications, you know, usually have some details. And sometimes there are other supplemental materials put out by the White House or departments and agencies. But aside from that, yeah, there are, you know, briefings that folks from the White House and the agencies do for Capitol Hill. There are the testimony when the cabinet officials come up and testify on the budget. And through that, there are, you know, Q&As in those hearings, as well as, they're called QFRs, questions for the record. Sometimes those things can bear fruit. Sometimes they don't. In fact, I was just made aware that Secretary Becerra, who was up this past Thursday before the Senate Finance Committee, the QFRs, the questions for the record that he was asked last year on the budget for fiscal year 24 were just delivered this week to the committees and the members. So it took a year and they got answers. Those aren't generally public, but they do sometimes get shared by staff. And oftentimes those answers are not too revealing. So not to discourage folks, but sometimes it's really difficult to get the detail you'd like behind some of these proposals. And I think, again, it kind of stems from, and I think it's easy to tell when a budget is real and has some serious proposals and there's more there versus a budget that's more of a political document in a, you know, election year where it's all about the messaging. And I think here we're kind of dealing with the latter. It is perfectly appropriate to use policy plugs and make assumptions and to lump, you know, a number of proposals together. But, you know, if the staff behind the scenes aren't willing or able to give you that additional detail, then maybe there isn't that detail there. So I think it's a fair question.
And how much political control is there over professional staff in a department and agency in the OMB when it comes to answering questions from the public or Capitol Hill?
I mean, I think everything, regardless of administration, gets filtered through the policy officials. So, you know, the career staff will help provide the technical answers, but before anything gets released publicly or to the Hill, it gets filtered through the policy staff who are our political appointees. So, and I think that's, you know, to make sure that everything is consistent with administration policy and, you know, the president's, you know, policies and proposals are reflected accurately, but it also does provide this extra political filter when they don't want to share something, you know, they frankly don't.
So I'm kind of stunned, to be honest with you, with the comment that Secretary Becerra's HHS just sent the answers up to last year's questions last week. I mean, yeah. I don't know what they're doing over there, but I think they've got enough time to answer questions.
Yeah, Joe, I think we had a better record than that. We were much faster.
Yeah, well, we tried to be, you know, I get it. I mean, you can't do it in a week because there is back and forth and there are, you know, the career staff and the politicals at HHS can have differences of opinion with the Office of Management and Budget about how something should be phrased or what was understood, or sometimes you have to run some numbers and pressure test the numbers. So you can't really do it in 48 hours for the most part. And it does take, but a year is ridiculous. Yeah.
364 days, you know, it was, I think the day before the hearing they were delivered.
Right.
It's a long time.
And I think their hearing last year was not this late in the year either. So it could be even old.
That's
it
right.
Could be even over a year since the last testimony. but so they also have, I don't know if there are any particular developments at HHS policy-wise. I mean, we've been watching a few things of interest. One is ARPA-H, which got $10 billion a couple of years ago and was created as sort of a health equivalent to the Defense Department's DARPA. So far, we're not seeing a lot of really big, exciting, throw-deep research projects that they've announced. DARPA, for instance, at the Defense Department, they have a track record of investing in really exciting research that private sector finds too expensive or too risky to invest in. Certainly they fail. That's the nature of the research enterprise. Often you fail, but it's got a tremendous, you know, success story. ARPA-H so far does not seem to have any big, bold research proposals. And their most recent one is to establish a public-private partnership for the regulation of artificial intelligence, which would look to people on its face as maybe inhibiting innovation in artificial intelligence, certainly to my mind. Do you see anything out of ARPA-H that's even remotely exciting?
Joe, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head from all the conversations I have and the stakeholder reactions. I mean, I think, you know, folks have been a little bit disappointed with ARPA-H. It's been more of the same, whether it's like, you know, NIH culture driven or HHS, you know, it's not as disruptive as DARPA. They're not doing big things. It's just, you know, the kinds of things you would expect out of the department.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't. And if you look at the budget, I mean, they continue to request the same amount of money for the same kinds of things, and don't, you know, see, I don't see major changes there. And Whether that's a culture change or leadership that's driving this, I'm not sure. But I do think the way you described it is pretty much the consensus of the folks who are following this thing closely in terms of the way it's played out so far.
So let's, and Eric, indulge me for 1 second. There's another one I want to push on with Greg, which is the $3 billion that was appropriated for the drug negotiation office at CMS to implement the Inflation Reduction Act. So $3 billion is a boatload of money to set up a new program. By contrast, I'm going to get the number wrong, but the Affordable Care Act, it was like less than $50 million, I believe, to set up the Affordable Care Act. When
I think it was $500 million.
$500 million. It was that much. Oh, okay.
I think so.
I'm wrong. Well, still,
still, that's
far more expansive piece of legislation. And with much more difficult to set up than this operation to negotiate the drug prices for 10 drugs. So we see them using the money, that appropriated money, in other ways, and the staff in other ways. For instance, the demonstration project, which they've announced for rare diseases, cell and gene in Medicaid. I don't know if you're following this at all, the CMMI demo for a nationwide negotiation and purchase of Medicaid drugs. Could you kind of unpack this for people about what was proposed in there? And to my mind, it's evidence that the $3 billion is bleeding out from its original purpose, and they're using the infrastructure that they've been building to implement the Inflation Reduction Act for different things, including the CMMI demo in Medicaid.
Yeah, so I saw the announcement of the demo. I haven't probably followed it as closely as you, Joe, but I wasn't aware they were using the $3 billion. Like, I learned something new today.
Well, I don't. Which is interesting. It's funny, and you know, if you, they haven't explicitly said it, but I don't see how they could do anything this sophisticated and this expansive without using the money. Certainly, when we were there, we did not have a discussion. First of all, it is creative. There's no question about it. You got to give them credit for it. But I just don't see how they could have done it without the expertise that they've been building up in the drug price negotiation to do this model.
Yeah, understood. Yeah, that makes sense. I'm going to have to dig in on that and find out a little more. What I will say is I do know the Hill, you probably recall last year around this time, did send a letter to Secretary Becerra asking about the $3 billion and information about, you know, how they plan to spend it and what funds have been apportioned and haven't been apportioned. And they did request routine briefings on this. I do not believe that those have been provided. And so I'll probably, after this podcast, dig in on those budget documents and some of the congressional justifications to see kind of what, if any, detail has been provided on the $3 billion. It's something that I'm definitely interested in and I'm tracking, but haven't had a chance to look at that yet.
Yeah, we should have a discussion in the future about this demonstration and its implications, because just top line, if it is true, I mean, I could be wrong, but I find it, I don't think I am. And if they're going to lean in on this and use CMMI, the demonstration authority and center at CMS, for more drug price negotiation, more creative purchasing arrangements beyond
expanding other conditions.
Yeah, beyond the Inflation Reduction Act. It has big implications for Medicaid, Medicare, and the drug companies.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Greg, this administration now has been at the reins here for 3+ years, has another year to run before the election. Kind of, what are some of your big picture takeaways about the Biden administration healthcare agenda, not just through the budget documents, but more generally overall? What are your conclusions about where they came from, what they're trying to do, and the consequences if they continue to have the power to persevere with their agenda?
Yeah, that's a great question, Eric. You know, I think obviously, you know, doubling down on, you know, the IRA and the Affordable Care Act, I mean, that's been you know, kind of what they've been proposing. I expect more of that in the future. One of the things we didn't talk about here, but I think is an important theme to mention that's been across all of their budgets. And I think, you know, fortunately hasn't been adopted by Congress, but it does say something about kind of their values, is like in each and every one of their budgets, they have proposed creating new sources of mandatory spending, but yet haven't helped address the current crisis and growth in our mandatory spending programs. And so, you know, for example, in this year's budget, there's $20 billion for, you know, preparedness and response, which, you know, is an important, you know, priority, of course. But, you know, Congress hasn't acted on a similar proposal in past budgets and will not likely. But if you think about that, I mean, I think, you know, kind of the general concept of, you know, not being serious on reining in mandatory spending, in fact, proposing new mandatory spending, I think says a lot about the values and the policy, you know, priorities of this administration and kind of what we likely see. And if President Biden were reelected, is more of the same in that regard. Again, fortunately, Congress, even when Democrats had, you know, full control, didn't enact these sorts of policies, but it shows you a little bit about how out of touch this administration is in terms of the fiscal realities that we face.
Yeah, and when it comes to the mandatory side of the House, it's great you point that out, because I think this budget this year has about $300 billion of spending that they want to pick up from the discretionary side and move over to the mandatory side. And for our listeners, a reminder, mandatory spending is forever. And then as well, to reinforce your point, they want to create about $80 billion worth of new mandatory spend, which again would be in perpetuity and then subject to further expansions over time. So,
and Eric, that's in the that's in the context of an additional $2.5 trillion in new mandatory spending over the 10-year period in general, overall. Right. Right. So, you know, proposing increases in mandatory spending and then these new pots of mandatory spending. So, didn't mean to interrupt, but I mean that's sort of the context we're dealing with here. And so, if we're going to get our fiscal house in order, it wouldn't be under a term two of a Biden administration.
Agreed. And thanks for the additional point. So in terms of fiscal irresponsibility, one last thing before we break. You know, over the past 20 plus years, there's been about, you know, nearly $3 trillion in improper payments from the federal government across a wide variety of fronts, in particular in a lot of mandatory spending programs. It was just $236 billion, according to the president's own budget documents that came out on his budget in improper payments just last year. There are lots of people, clearly, who focus on this problem and try to push for solutions, but for some reason, this problem persists. What are some ways that people should be thinking about how to approach that, either with your old budget hat on or just with your budgeteer hat on, to try to get a hold of, reduce, and ultimately eliminate the sort of improper payments we see across the board in so many federal spending programs?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Eric. And I think something that requires focus. I mean, I don't know if you noticed the former president alluded to this, President Trump, last week, and then was lambasted by the Democrats for bringing up eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse, you know, these things like improper payments. But these are the low-hanging fruit that I think we ought to be focusing on first. I mean, if we're going to start somewhere in terms of getting our fiscal house in order, this is where I would focus. You know, it's a really difficult problem to solve, in part because of the way these programs are structured and run. You know, it's kind of, they're kind of ancient. But there's obvious cases of fraud. And, you know, for example, in the hospice space, I can speak to some of that. You know, our federal agencies are, you know, somewhat clueless in terms of the way that they manage these programs. And I think we need to think through how do we actually modernize CMS so that they're actually capable of cutting off the crooks when you have people who are defrauding a federal program. You know, how do we actually track that? How do we prosecute them? How do we prevent them from billing Medicare? And I think that, you know, those sorts of problems are fixable, but it'll require really reforming these programs and these bureaucracies in order to do that effectively in the 21st century. And I just don't think that we're there yet as a federal government. We haven't thought about these problems differently. We are constantly, chasing the fraud when in fact we could be preventing it, but we just haven't modernized the way we run these programs and pay for care.
And Joe, you mentioned AI a little earlier. Is it possible that that's potentially a tool here to address this significant fraudulent payment problem that we've got across the federal government?
Oh, I definitely think so. I mean, I think we should be devoted to using AI in a number of different government programs to identify improper payments and simplify various bureaucratic processes, and to the extent and speed them up, instead of having some human beings actually engaged in very mundane tasks that in many cases are no longer necessary and antiquated, we should be spinning up AI. I don't necessarily think, I'm not of the camp that you can turn off human reason to an artificial intelligence tool, but you certainly can eliminate a lot of steps, and you certainly could identify patterns that would indicate fraud and allow you to claw some of this money back and prevent it in the first place. There's no reason that this shouldn't be job number one, which is one of the things that I find so disappointing about the Biden administration's approach to AI. It is very much the precautionary principle around regulation and very much about restraining the private sector, which should be allowed to innovate. And we don't know where this technology is going to go, but they should be using, I mean, if ARPA-H was going to do something positive instead of becoming a super regulator, develop AI to eliminate improper payments in one Medicare program, just pick one and work with a artificial intelligence company to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse and develop efficiencies for better customer service for taxpayers. That would be a huge help and demonstrate success. But instead, they're scaremongering about the evil private sector out there. And I think it's a very unfortunate squandered opportunity.
Don't disagree. And it sounds like this is a fruitful area for both further policy development in the private sector and the federal government, but also a future episode or two of our podcast. So I want to thank Greg D'Angelo for joining us on DCEKG. Very much appreciate, Greg, your input and hope you'll be able to come back again. We'd also like to thank our sponsor, Survivors for Solutions, our executive producer, our spirit guide, John C.C. Swartacki, our producer, Lauren Timmerman, our distribution partner, Big Wig Media, and our production team, Evergreen. On behalf of DCEKG, this is Eric Euland with our host, Joe Grogan. Thanks for listening. We'll be talking.